Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. And she uses all of these skills as we address the subjects that we're all grappling with, especially today in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Election Day, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Brad. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Better to be here than huddled at my house, rocking back and forth in some form.
Yes. I'm right there with you.
And I know that we're not alone, because it's an interesting thing, you know, being out in the world on a day like today, especially when people know that you're a psychotherapist, because everyone kind of wants to tap in as if, you know, I might have some magic mojo to help people to feel a little bit better. Even I had my teeth cleaned this morning and my dental hygienist had me kind of there.
Yes.
And so I got to kind of help absorb her anxieties about, you know, what's happening and what potentially could happen. And in many ways, that's all, you know, we can do for each other is just to sit and listen and empathize and say, yep, that is where we're at today. And, you know, I had after I finished that, I went swam this morning first thing, which is my calm place. And it was so nice because there was absolutely no one at the pool. I was by myself and it was such a great swim. And usually by the end of the hour, you know, when I hit that mile mark, I've already gone through all of kind of whatever I was grappling with or worried about. And usually that's where my show ideas come up from.
Sure.
So it was great, you know, start that way. Came home, went to the dentist, finished that. And then my daughter called and she said, you know, Mom, the thing that's so strange is that I start off the day totally normally because she has two kids. She's super busy. You know, she's running from place to place, doing her normal day things. And she said, yet I know in this deep spot that I wake up tomorrow, everything in my life or in the world might be totally different. And it's so surreal because everything just feels like the same day or the everyday for me. And so I appreciate that as well. And now, in the world of psychotherapy, anxiety is the most common of all of the mental health concerns or issues, along with depression that we see. And depression and anxiety tend to go hand in hand and play off of each other. And on that spectrum of anxiety disorders, you know, you can range from having phobias and fears about specific things that make us anxious to panic attacks, which tend to come out of nowhere, which makes them so uncomfortable or terrifying. And then there's the generalized anxiety that people feel just floating around, you know, in their life. And then there is the existential angst, anxiety. What is the meaning of life? And of all of the anxiety flavors, really the most challenging or crippling of them all is anticipatory anxiety. And that's the anxiety that comes when you know something is going to happen, but you don't know what it is and you can't change it or control it. And it just has to play out. And it's difficult to sit still. It's difficult to find that calm space. You know, all of the tools that people use for anxiety, whether it's fidget spinning or tapping or going for a walk or doing their breathing to try to find that calm space, swimming for an hour. A lot of it, it's more difficult to find that kind of set point again when we're dealing with anticipatory anxiety because it is so uncertain and you feel so out of control. And just a side note for those who struggle with anxiety, usually the more high functioning you are, the more prone you're going to be for anxiety, because usually very high functioning people also are kind of into controlling everything that they possibly can. And anxiety is something that's completely out of our control. And so the two tend to dance together and make it really a challenging issue. So I'm feeling on edge yet calm, anxious and at peace, and it all kind of comes in waves. And I thought, well, today we'll open the phone lines and just let people kind of talk about that anticipatory anxiety that they may or may not be feeling, because it's not universal. Another conversation I had this morning was with someone who said, you know, my life doesn't change whatever happens after today, and so I really don't worry about it either way. Everything just goes on the way it was. So it's not universal that everyone is having what we call election anxiety or election anticipatory anxiety. But I'm happy to hear how people are feeling, no matter where they are today, with their emotions or their expectations. And then I also thought it might be helpful to have a conversation with Dr. Carrie Langner, who was here a few weeks ago, talking about a project that she and Dr. Lee are doing around bullying reduction in elementary school. So it was a great conversation.
Yeah.
And Dr. Langner is a professor and also the department chair of the Psychology and Child Development Department at Cal Poly. And she recently did a talk on campus with one of the professors from the political science department about political violence and the history of it and what constitutes political violence and, you know, how to recognize the potential for political violence. And so I wanted to bring part of that talk to the show today as well, because I know part of the anticipatory anxiety is this looming threat of potential political violence, no matter what the outcome is after the election. And so I know that's on a lot of people's minds as well. So I thought Carrie might be able to bring some insight on that. So that's where we're going today. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875. You can also be part of the conversation after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or you can leave me a message on our Instagram or Facebook page, and I'm happy to get back to you there. You can listen to previous shows, including the previous show we did on bullying in elementary schools or reducing the bullying, by visiting kcbx.org and look under the News Talk tab, and there's years of shows there to choose from. Or if you'd like to podcast our show to listen at your convenience, you can go wherever it is you get your podcasts and search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and they'll be there for you to listen at your convenience. So that's our story. We're going to take a quick break and come back and have Dr. Langner join us right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Seems I've got to have a chance to see you. Every night I have the strangest dream. Impressing by the way I could have been. Left you on my own arm, so it seems I've got to leave before I start to scream. Cause someone left the door and took the key.
You feeling alright?
I'm not feeling too good myself.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And Dr. Langner, thank you for joining me on the show again today.
Thanks, Elizabeth. I always enjoy speaking with you.
Oh, thanks. And I'm curious to know where you are in the emotional spectrum, how you're feeling today or have been feeling.
I have seen a phrase on Twitter and other places that I found really amusing, but I felt really described where I'm at, which is nauseously optimistic. So I am one of the people on edge because just the range of issues that will be affected by the outcome of the election, but also feeling optimistic. And I was thinking, you know, in the intro while you were speaking, it reminded me of all the kind of unsung heroes, just average citizens who have been doing the work for, you know, over a year of making sure to first get out the vote, make sure that people have access and are registered. And then also, you know, just an example from the Cal Poly campus, we had a group of folks working for many months to make sure not only to get out the vote, but to make sure that people have the resources that they need, polling places are protected, and, you know, that there's information out there, you know, particularly focusing on students, you know. But I think, you know, I've been seeing all of these folks who are volunteering across the country, you know, working at polls, working on keeping accessibility for people to vote. And that's really inspiring.
I agree. And also, when people are looking for the prescription or, you know, to try to reduce anxiety, it's mm-hmm. always action. Do something.
Yeah. And the whole, it's a little bit different, but I was thinking about Mr. Rogers saying, always look for the helpers, you know, and I just find that that's useful in a lot of different contexts, you know, to look around your community and see who's helping, you know, that helps us, I think, orient towards what are the positive actions we can take.
Yes. And to not feel so kind of alone or isolated in wherever you're spinning, because mm-hmm. just having a conversation, you know, with your dental hygienist can be helpful. You know, and I always am happy, you know, when I start a conversation with anyone, whether I'm in a store or on the street, or I'm probably annoying because I do love to start conversations. But it's always reassuring that so many people equally want to have a conversation and connect mm-hmm. and share. And so it is a good time to reach out in those small ways on a day like this, so that we don't, because the danger, right, is that we get so caught up in our own spin that everything feels overwhelming.
Yeah, definitely. I think being in community, you know, for positive events, but also stressful events is so important.
I agree. So the reason that I invite you, although I'd have you back all the time to chat, but specifically for today, was the lecture that you gave about political violence a couple of weeks ago. And I wanted to follow up, and I'm curious to know what inspired you. And I wasn't sure which political science professor you had done this talk with.
Yeah, it was really a great experience. It was organized by the political science department, and I guess this shows how open-minded and interdisciplinary they are, but they actually invited me from psychology, and then there was a philosopher and a historian. So it was truly an interdisciplinary discussion about political violence, and I learned a lot. For people who are interested in the history of political violence in the United States, I was going to mention my colleague's name, Tanai Jackson. She's a professor in history. And even if you just Google Tanai Jackson and Cal Poly, you'll see there was an article in the Cal Poly magazine that you can access. Her first name is spelled Thanayi. And then Jackson, how you would expect. Mm-hmm. And it was really very helpful to think about kind of the historical context for some of the things that we've been seeing recently, and recognize that when there are these, you know, contests over who has power, you know, there are sometimes groups in society who don't want to respect the outcomes of an election, and so that's where some of the risks develop, you know, whether it was, you know, most recently a couple years ago with the attack on the Capitol, or in the case she was discussing in the Reconstruction era, you know, where multiracial government was overturned violently. And so I found that really helpful just personally to think about kind of the broader context. It helps you kind of step back from some of the specifics and see what's going on. I think in a more cohesive kind of way.
So this whole idea of political violence then is not something new to this generation.
Right. And I think we can look at a pretty kind of wide range of examples of violence. When I, you know, on this panel, I had asked to participate because I was really interested in having a voice there to address issues of dehumanization and some of these other psychological processes that can ready the stage for violence. And I had done some work earlier in my career in Washington, D.C., where I was part of a group working to advance hate crime legislation. And so I had done some policy work, you know, around understanding the differences between hate speech and hate crime. But I think the theme that I see throughout is when you move from kind of individual level violence to group level, that's where I think it becomes very relevant in the political context. So either someone being targeted because of a group they belong to, so racialized violence, or, you know, whether in the case of the attack on the Capitol, right, those partisan groups using violence to advance their agenda.
So what then constitutes, well, I kind of wanted to go back because you mentioned that there was political violence was in the 1800s, right after or during Reconstruction.
Yeah. So that was on the panel, Dr. Jackson spoke about a case in North Carolina where a multiracial government was overthrown. So it was a coup that occurred, you know, in the history of the United States. And it was, in some places you'll see it called a massacre. So very extreme violence in that case. Maybe, I think, some relevance to what we saw with the attack on the Capitol. And, you know, we know there was more loss of life in this earlier example of a political coup. But in both cases, lots of physical violence.
So how do we get to a place where violence kind of takes over, you know, because people have deep, deep feelings about their beliefs or, you know, who they want to be in power. But what triggers the move to violence? What's the progression, I guess?
Yeah, the part of the panel where I spoke about this and maybe what we can chat a little bit about here, from a psychological perspective, one really important piece has to do with the relevant social norms. So not necessarily what each individual thinks is right or wrong, but what do they perceive as being normal or abnormal in a particular situation. And so what we see in the social psychological research is that when social norms shift, and we could think about, you know, messages from political leaders that may condone and normalize violence, for instance, those kind of broader influences and then seeing other people engaging in political violence, unfortunately can have the effect of increasing the likelihood that other people are going to engage in violence. The other psychological piece that I think is really important is how in our political rhetoric we talk about different groups in society. And so I think many of us are familiar with some of the propaganda from the World War II era, Nazi propaganda that was portraying European Jews in a particular manner that was dehumanizing. So political cartoons, right, where people, you know, human beings are portrayed as vermin or things to be eradicated. It's not always the case with dehumanization. You can also see, I guess it's cousin, demonization, where, you know, Jews have been portrayed as these highly agentic group, meaning not animalistic, but instead this kind of evil mastermind kind of stereotype. In both cases, right, that's language that is attempting to define or describe a group of people in a way that makes violence against them more acceptable. So I think, you know, when we were talking earlier about what are the warning signs, those are some of the things that I would pay attention to. Are our political leaders normalizing violence, kind of joking about it, saying it's okay to rough up a reporter, for instance? Do we see political conversations in which groups of people are being compared to animals, being treated as kind of evil people who are coming in to do something awful to your family? All of those kinds of images and constructions are really important in terms of laying out space where it's easier for people to engage in violence, and maybe just a very small number of people ultimately.
And I remember when I took political science classes, they talked about the dehumanization or demonization of the enemy to in wars to make it easier or more palatable, I guess, for the soldiers to be able to go in and wipe out, you know, populations of people. They would come up with, you know, names or slurs for the enemy so they didn't have human association. Right. So that seems like it's similar.
Yes, I think there are debates, I think, you know, within the scholarship in this area about the extent to which, you know, it's not always dehumanization that is driving, you know, for instance, some of these genocidal behaviors. But I think it's a pretty well well-researched area, this idea that if someone is dehumanized, it does make it feel potentially more acceptable to put kind of legal restrictions on them, you know, all the way down the spectrum to engaging in violence against them.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Dr. Carrie Langner. She is a professor of psychology and the chair of the Psychology and Child Development Department at Cal Poly and teaches multicultural psychology, social psychology, and health psychology. And I think the two, Carrie, roll in together because we talked about the project you're doing in the elementary schools, looking at the curriculum around bullying and reducing bullying. And I'm wondering if the two of these things kind of intersect, that bullying behavior, if it's not recognized or talked about, can then lead to a dehumanization or demonization of others in order to, I don't know, justify bullying, whether, you know, it's elementary school or in politics.
I would definitely agree that, you know, the reason I'm interested in these topics, there is a kind of theme throughout. And, you know, some of this may have started back when I was working in the field of hate crime legislation. And I look at, I guess, political violence, hate crimes, hate speech. To me, these are our most extreme examples of what can happen when we demonize other social groups, when we engage in discrimination. But I would say that the whole spectrum is of interest to me, and the reason for getting involved with the project in the elementary schools, you know, were a couple of reasons. I, at the time I started it, had two children in elementary school, so there was that personal interest, but in terms of the kind of scholarly interest, to me it seemed like a really important thing to be able to identify where we can intervene before we get to the point of, say, high school, where you might see students racially segregating themselves or engaging in racist speech. How do we move back, developmentally speaking, and try to prevent some of that? So, yeah, I think it's all connected under this umbrella of how do social groups with more and less social power interact with one another, and how do we take steps to hopefully create more equitable spaces and then certainly more safety from physical violence.
Well, and I'm trying to make this link, so tell me if I'm on the right track. But in the curriculum that you're talking about, a lot of it seemed to be about if you see something, say something, instead of, you know, just having the individual who's being bullied learn to stand up for themselves, or which seems to be kind
exactly
of the original motivation. Instead, have the whole group come together and say, this isn't okay. We don't treat people like this. And to have kind of that be the group power is to stand up for each other and not turn on each other. And it feels like if you project this, you know, if we're catching these kids in third grade, 8, 9, 10 years old, and they get used to speaking out for each other and speaking out against bullying, name calling, which, you know, is very common, or trying to demean people or demoralize them, if they've had this experience while they're young, I would imagine by the time they're in college and then out in the world and maybe running for office, we've changed the social norm about how we engage. Because it feels like right now, and I'm sorry, I'm going too far ahead, but it feels like right now, you know, what's normalized in the adult arena of politics is that name calling, finger pointing, dehumanizing, belittling, demeaning, is the status quo or the normal in a political battle. And I wonder if by starting this young, that might be something that shifts the social norm.
That's the hope. And you said it better than I could. And that's what we would hope, that by building these skills where people challenge behaviors that they don't see as fitting in terms of the social context that they want to create. So say it's your school, you're a principal, you're a teacher, you're a student, and you want this space to be open to everyone, that everyone has access to education and a safe learning environment, that part of maintaining that is naming it when something's happened that doesn't fit with those goals. And so being an upstander, you know, that's what we call it, instead of a bystander, we want the kids to be upstanders. But you'll see, you know, at the college level and other spaces as well, a lot of really interesting interventions that you could put under this broad category of bystander intervention. So really trying to encourage people to say something. And, you know, I had the opportunity to interact with some of the kids at one of our local elementary schools last week. It was really a wonderful experience. The teacher had created a climate where the students were very invested in their classmates' well-being and also just very curious, lots of questions. And so we had a chat. We opened it up for Q&A with this classroom, third grade students. And, you know, they really wanted to understand, you know, how much would it really help, you know, if I disagree with, you know, something that someone said that was mean to another student. And what we were talking about, you know, in more kind of maybe developmentally appropriate terms was that they have a bit of a say in what those social norms are in their classroom and on the playground. And that it is very powerful when a peer steps up and says, you know, I don't like what you just called this other student, or that's, you know, don't do that. That's not what we do at our school. It might not have a sudden effect, but what I was talking to them about is next time, you know, the person's going to think a little more carefully about making a statement like that. And we were also really careful to talk about it, you know, with children. You can imagine they're all growing, developing, making mistakes, figuring things out. I mean, I would say, I guess, adults are doing that as well. It's a little bit easier to be empathetic to, I think, a third grader who said something rude. So we talked about being really calm but confident. So you're not there to start a fight with someone. You're there just to name, you know, a shared value and get that person back on course. And I think that makes it a little bit easier to imagine doing, right? We're not asking them to get into an argument with another student. It's really just about defending your classmates and reiterating, right, what you want your norm to be.
So I wonder how things would change in our society or in our culture, because I can't imagine that we go on like this for another 4 or 8 years. I feel incredibly uncomfortable myself, and I can't imagine anyone wants to continue feeling this kind of vitriol that's passed back and forth and feels so, I don't know, just demoralizing. But I also understand, you know, that at times in my life where I've said something and either one of my girls, who are the ones that tend to be who call me out the most, or, you know, if something has come up in class and someone says, that doesn't sound right to me, or I don't think I don't know if that was what you meant to say. Even for myself, in the moment, I feel embarrassed and a little defensive, but then I'm always thankful. It's like, oh, I'm so glad that you said something instead of just harboring negative feelings about me and giving me an opportunity to rethink what I said or how does this fit. It makes us stronger when someone tells us, hey, what you said didn't hit me right. Because I don't think I don't believe that people intentionally try to wound others often. I think generally it's a defense or some sort of insecurity that they're using because they don't have a better argument. So it becomes, I feel like I'm losing in this moment, so my better argument seems to be to put you down. But more often than not, if someone hears from another that something they've said feels uncomfortable, they take that information and grow.
If you're
just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, here with my guest today, Dr. Carrie Langner from Cal Poly. And we're kind of talking about those election day jitters, anticipatory anxiety, kind of the unknown that we're all sitting with, and also political violence and that looming threat that no matter what the outcome is, there could be more shifts and more violence and more divisions. And how do we prepare that for that, but also how do we think longer term? Because we see where we are, and so we need to be able to do something different. And it looks like that change is going to have to start at a much younger age, because it's difficult to change embedded habits of adults. Now, when we come back, Carrie may want to argue that, but it feels like it'd be much more difficult to change the embedded behaviors in adult communities than it is to help the younger generation come up and make change. Our number is 805-781-3875. We're going to take a quick break and come back and open up the phone lines. We'd love to hear from you as well. 805-781-3875. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Like a small boat on the ocean, sending big waves into motion. Like how a single word can make a heart open. I might only have one match, but I can make an explosion. And all those things I didn't say were wrecking balls inside my brain. I will scream loud tonight. Can you hear my voice this time? This is my fight song. Take back my life.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist, here today with my guest, Dr. Carrie Langner. All right, Carrie. So I kind of jumped, I threw something in your lap, and I want to kind of go back to it about being able to reduce the vitriol in political discourse. And is it possible to change what seems to be just deeply entrenched anger? Can that be changed, or are we going to have to toss this group out and kind of start with the younger generation?
I am optimistic, and when you were mentioning that, it reminded me of a distinction between dialogue and debate. And I think that part of what, you know, not to assume this is the same for you, but I was relating to what you're saying about, you know, how much more of this can go on, right? Just mm-hmm. The kind of nastiness and, you know, superficial level debating in mm-hmm. some cases. Mm-hmm. And I do think that we can all engage in dialogue rather than debate in a number of spaces that we occupy. So I've heard about, you know, people really struggling across, for instance, partisanship within their family mm-hmm. to be able to have productive conversations. And I think that unfortunately, we're having it modeled for us this kind of debate, right, where you're rehearsing what you're going to say in response while the other person is talking rather than
and not listening to what's actually being said,
which mm-hmm. you could, you know, you do in fact teach classes on this.
Yes, I do.
It's all about this. But I was thinking about, you know, and I'm guilty of this as well. I think when you were really passionate about an issue, rights that we feel are being infringed, it's just instinct in some cases, right, to be marshaling all your arguments, right, getting ready to kind of pull apart what the other person has suggested. And so I think dialogue can be much more productive. It takes a lot of work, but I think people can do it, where you really try to delve in and understand what maybe the underlying fears, values, mm-hmm. concerns are. Mm-hmm. And I think by trying to understand where, you know, each of us are coming from, that can be a much more productive kind of conversation, mm-hmm. even if we're not landing right on the same position, like we don't agree on the same policy. I think as much as we can focus on that and kind of turn off maybe some of the arguing on cable news, for instance, and have the kind of conversations that you were talking about, right, where your point in your conversation with your dental hygienist is probably not to necessarily change her mind, right, but to understand someone else and have a connection. Maybe it's not a good example because you're sitting there kind of vulnerable with your mouth open. Maybe there are better examples. But that's where I would have hope for all of us adults, is to try to engage more in dialogue. And also, you know, there's a professor here at Cal Poly who I was really impacted by her suggestion that when we're engaged in social change and we're working for equity, that we really think about where we're spending our energy. Mm-hmm. So do I want to go argue with a white nationalist? Not really. I don't think it's particularly productive, right? But there are a lot of people who can find common ground, right, where those dialogues are going to be more productive, right, where people are willing to learn from one another.
But I love your hopefulness in life, but I think because I think that I have I'm the reluctant therapist, so I think I always fall a little bit more on the skeptical side, and there is a part of me that feels like we have to outlive this this cultural norm that we've fallen into, and that I have hope for the younger generation. I really believe in this Gen Z group, because they're willing to say to me in class, "Professor Barrett, I'm not sure if you meant to say that." And I'll say, "What?" I mean, that's gives me such great hope. It's like, okay, how did that not work for you? And that's where I see the change coming. They are speaking out. I think also the fact that it only takes 20% of the population changing their beliefs about something to change a social norm. So I think I have more hope for that. And of course, that's where I invest my energy, is in this younger generation, preparing them to take it. Because I don't know, Carrie, the idea that we're going to find common ground and be able to change, I think the challenge is that we come from this very depletion versus abundance mindset, and that if we give any part of our position away, we lose so much ground. And so there's, instead of looking at abundance, that there can be room for a lot of different ways for people to be. But I think we just, it's almost like a depression era mindset that, you know, it's all going to go away. And so we need to grab onto it as hard as we can and make sure no one challenges how we
feel. And that's being taken advantage of, I would say. There are very clearly political actors who stoke fear because they know that they can manipulate that and utilize that. I think the reason I'm still optimistic about a variety of generations, although I will agree, you know, that I've seen this evolution in my students where I feel like there's such emotional intelligence compared to my own generation, you know, earlier on in life, which I love. But I was having this discussion actually with my teenage daughter in the car the other day, where I think she would agree with you. She would say, we just gotta move on for the younger people. And I was saying to her, you know, there are so many elders who have led the fight for equality.
Agreed.
And so I think while I hear what you're saying about, for some folks, there's going to be very little willingness to shift. I think there's quite a variety. So, you know, I wouldn't give up on that entirely. And I've also really enjoyed, you know, Sarah Bartlett in our department does a lot of intergenerational work. And I've really enjoyed getting to learn about that and seeing some of the activities that she's held, you know, where elders in the community are meeting with college students, and then there's preschoolers involved. So I do think there's a lot of room there for dialogue still.
I agree. I'm not completely lost in the world. I just also want to encourage the younger generation to step into their place.
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, speaking with my guest, Dr. Carrie Langner from Cal Poly's Psychology and Child Development Department. And our number is 805-781-3875 if you'd like to be part of the conversation. And Alicia, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
What's on your mind today?
This is a subject that is so dear to my heart, and how it's so easy for us to become violent when we haven't understood we're reacting rather than understanding what need of ours is not getting met in that moment. I've done a lot of work with Marsha Rosenberg's nonviolent communication and alternatives to violence in groups and in prisons and with mental health facilities. And I have come to realize that anything we say or do is our attempt to meet one of our human needs. It's just that sometimes our attempts aren't very effective because we're not aware of what the need is. We're judging and blaming rather than going inside and saying, what is it that I'm needing in this moment? Is it understanding? Is it skill? Is it space? Is it rest? Is it love? Is it acceptance?
Opportunity.
Yeah.
I think that's what we'd probably hear a lot today. If we were to open up that question, a lot of it would be around opportunities and time to enjoy life and not always feel overwhelmed and burdened. It feels like that. Carrie, did you have anything to add?
That's really a great point. And it really aligns with some research I was looking at for this panel that I was on the other day, where a number of scholars have tried to identify what puts people at risk for engaging in political violence. And while there's that piece about, you know, the political rhetoric or the ideologies out there that are justifying violence, there seems to be also an aspect of the individual's need to be personally significant, to feel some sense of power. But I think that's a really helpful way to think about, you know, where some of these risk factors might be. And I feel like it gives some pretty clear direction, right, on how we might intervene. Like, what do we need to be doing to sort of protect our communities from this kind of violence?
Alicia, anything else?
Well, in Marshall Rosenberg's Nonviolent Communication, he talks about empathy, but in offering empathy to guests, either out loud or silently, what the other person's need is. So if someone says, you're stupid, it's not about you being stupid. It's about their need for maybe possibly recognition, understanding, acceptance, whatever, you know.
Beautiful.
But we wouldn't know. They're the expert on their needs. We just need to maybe guess.
Yeah.
Are you feeling frustrated or angry because you want to be acknowledged?
Yeah.
Or want to be understood?
Yeah, Alicia, thank you. That's such great points, and I appreciate you calling in because I do feel like that's something, Carrie, that might not really be talked about in trying to bring dialogue as opposed to debate, is to, and I guess it takes a little bit of self-awareness maybe and emotional maturity to be able to say, I'm this angry. What is it that I need that's not, what need is of mine is not being met that's causing me to be so angry? And I wonder if that would not feel threatening to someone. Our number is 805-781-3875 to be part of the conversation. And Joel, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today? I mean, good on edge, calm, anxious, at peace, nervous, all of that, yes.
Well, I'm approaching this from a different angle.
Okay.
As in, I see this as a historical opportunity. And basically, what we have is we have 30 years in decline of democracy. So there are groups or agencies that track this worldwide, and there are only two forms of human collaboration. You either have an authoritarian top-down, or you have a free, democratic, and self-determinant from the bottom up. And they're always in conflict. This is what we're experiencing is nothing more than, in my opinion, nothing more than the latest version or the latest iterations of this conflict. Hmm. And so the reason that we're in trouble is because democracy is failing. And Buckminster Fuller said, you know, dare to be naive. We're intended to be architects of the future and not its victims. You never change things from within. If you want to change something, build a new model that makes the previous model obsolete. And our system is so messed up. It's corrupted, like criminally corrupted, but it's also corrupted like a hard disk. And I believe that what we're failing to do is recognize the most powerful tool or weapon that humanity has ever invented, which is the internet. And yet we're not accepting the responsibility to use the internet and to make the internet what we need it to be. And that 30-year decline in democracy correlates directly with the 30 years of increase of our lives on the internet. So is that a concept that makes sense to you guys?
Carrie, I'll let you jump in.
Okay. I would agree that there are a number of ways in which we really are struggling to have democratic elections. And, you know, I know that President Obama and some of his former staff were working on these issues after he left office. And so I think I don't have enough data to say whether or not I think, you know, we're in an upswing or still a decline in terms of everyone having their right to vote respected. I do agree that there's just at an international level, right, we have rising fascism, and we have corruption of a lot of political processes. You know, I think it's too big a topic for me to kind of jump into the internet piece. But what I will say is that misinformation and disinformation are obviously huge problems. And whereas we may have had, you know, propaganda, misinformation out there in the past, this is, you know, amped up to, you know, many, many degrees of freedom to really, I think, be quite difficult for us to keep up in terms of regulation and monitoring that.
Which I think it wouldn't be, from my perspective, Joel, is that it's not going to be solved, and I'm going back to, it's not going to be solved by this generation, but it's going to be solved with the way we did with television when it first came around. Everyone was so concerned about the impact on the younger generation, and so we started teaching television or viewing literacy. We're going to have to start teaching internet literacy before kids even start using the phone or internet, so it becomes part of their education. That's the only way I see us coming around.
Isn't Cal Poly a learn by doing university? Isn't that their mantra?
That's what we work with. Yes.
Yeah.
So, in my mind, I'm writing a book about this, and I wrote some emails to 100 political science professors recently, and got zero response. And where are your universities practicing, participating in making it mandatory for your students to conduct political science experiments? I don't see the science. I'm not a college graduate, and I'm not familiar with the programs, but I look at these universities as, you know, like petri dishes in a free and democratic society. If this is the science of politics that's being taught, and it's taught at a university that claims learn by doing, why aren't we seeing more of that? I believe,
Joel, I have to jump in because I have a couple other calls. But what you're talking about is probably a bigger conversation than the show. And it might be something worth me checking in with some of my political science colleagues and maybe bringing that as a topic. So send me, if you get a chance.
Add a little item, which is that I think this all, you know, falls under what we are doing at Cal Poly. And granted, it's difficult, you know, to kind of peek into what is going on in every single department, but a huge part of a liberal arts education, you know, the college where political science and my department, psychology and child development, are housed, you know, a huge part of our service to the broader university is in this area of critical thinking and ethics. So, you know, I believe we're engaged in that, and maybe it's a matter of kind of sharing that out with the community in ways that are easier to access.
Agreed. Joel, thank you for taking the time to call. And our number is 805-781-3875. Tom, you're on the air. Are you there?
What I wanted to express.
I'm sorry, Tom. I cut you off real quick. You're on the air now. What's on your mind?
What I wanted to express is that you don't seem to be talking about what's going on with the legacy media in this nation. And meaning it's a game, whether you're talking about MSNBC or Fox News or whatever, where they, you know, basically they have a Monday morning meeting and decide, you know, what they're going to, how they're going to rile the troops being their audience or their conceived of audience, and getting them mad and really around some issue. And then they, you know, they have different guests on, and they rip them apart, you know, depending on, you know, who it is. And so, I mean, this is the great example for nastiness.
Well,
and it's right there, you know. So I mean, and you know, why are they doing this? To get ratings, to get money, to sell ads, so they can pay pay people. That's what they're. That's what's going on.
So Tom, what is the solution? How do we change this?
I have no idea. I think I'm older than you, substantially. Do you remember anyone talking about Walter Cronkite?
Well, yeah. I remember Walter Cronkite, and it's funny because I was going to bring him up when Joel called.
He was a very, very, very liberal person. If one, and no one really knew this till he died. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone thought he was kind of middle of the road. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't at all, you know. But he, you know, had that demeanor, and he was good for his audience in that he was kind of very even-handed in what he was talking about.
And
you
so
know, whatever the thought was, a big part of it was the Vietnam War.
Yeah. We had so few outlets for, I think that's really, from my perspective, the biggest challenge is that there's so many ways to access information that it's mm-hmm. hard to have any sort of unified vision. And in ways that it can be really damaging, having unified vision can marginalize parts of the population. But in the ways a unified vision can be powerful, that's, I think, how, you know, the only way we get back together. And it, like after 9/11, we had that one little tiny moment in time where we could have had a unified vision about how we move forward as a people. And until we have another sort of moment, trauma, crisis that gives us a window, I don't know how we get there. But Tom, please.
I don't know either. I mean, I'm not here to have some great answer. Yeah. I'm just saying that, you know, what you're talking about is, it seems to me like one is dancing around the real issue.
Yeah.
And the real issue is money.
Yeah.
Money and getting ratings.
Agreed.
That's the real issue.
Agreed.
I do think there's a couple, you know, things that we could look at in terms of increasing, I guess, what you might call like kind of political intelligence, you know, mm-hmm. in our democracy. And I was thinking about a colleague who had mentioned, you know, had grown up in another country, and she had mentioned how she found it so interesting that now that she's in the United States, that people will rarely have, you know, the kind of political conversations that were very, very common where she grew up, where people would be talking about it around a meal. And so it's interesting to me that we have maybe this gap between these very angry, vitriolic debates going on, you know, on network television or cable television.
We're being angry with our neighbors. I mean, come on. Yeah. I mean, our neighbors have a right to have a different opinion than we have, and we can have a discussion about it. Okay. And we shouldn't be at each other's throats.
Agreed. And, you know, this is a conversation that is not just a one-show conversation. Yeah. It's always a giant issue. So, Tom, thank you for calling. Carrie, thank you for being on the show today. I appreciate you taking your time to share your wisdom. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Thank you for tuning in, listening, and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.